Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And this is a program, as our regular listeners know, of people who come to tell a wonderfully personal and compelling story about life lived beautifully in some way or other. And so often life lived beautifully really is a matter of accepting experience and overcoming challenges and just knowing what you're doing with grace and gratitude. So with that, I'm going to go directly to our guest, Angie Chow, who is the author of a book called Quiet as They Come. And Angie, I'm just going to ask you to talk to us about you. And I don't know, I know you came here when you were four. Maybe you could just tell us about your experience and your life as a toddler immigrant.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me here. And I love the concept of your program. So
I'm glad we do.
I'm excited about it. I came to the U.S. when I was four with my family, and we were boat people and fled from Vietnam after the fall of Saigon.
And do you want to say for people who might not know what the phrase boat people refers to?
Yeah, so these are people who escaped the country by boat because it was once the communists took over South Vietnam, it became illegal to flee and leave the country. However, many families like mine, middle-class families, educated people, were persecuted because of their backgrounds. And my father was a philosophy professor, and my mom was a pharmacist. And as a result of that, they, I think, just wanted to have more opportunity for our family.
They wouldn't have been able to do that under a new regime in the same way had you stayed?
I don't think so. There were men in my family who were being sent to re-education camps, and you know, some people were imprisoned. I have an uncle who was a high-ranking officer in the South Vietnamese Army, and he was imprisoned. And one of the short stories in my collection, it's fictional. It's a fictionalized account, but it's certainly inspired by his trials and tribulations.
So, what do you remember of that? Move over a little bit. What do you remember of your journey here? Do you remember anything as a four-year-old?
I do. I remember. I remember being at the refugee camp in Malaysia, and it actually being this really fun experience because, you know, my father was teaching us how to swim at these lovely oceans and was, you know, teaching us how to make kites out of old newspapers and old, you know, molded up or old rice. And
so
how
you were
to
safe with your
glue.
Family. So you didn't feel a threat.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was so young that I felt protected, and I didn't feel a threat. And it's only in retrospect, as a college student and as an adult learning more about my family's history and about the Vietnam War, that it dawned on me how dire the consequences could have been, and how brave my parents were and my family was in making that journey.
Do they know that you know how brave they were?
I hope so. Yes. I mean, I think that my story collection in a lot of ways is this love letter to our family and all of the immigrants out there that took on the journey.
Well, I want to get to the story in your book also and how you came to write that. But what did your parents do when they came here? Could your mother work as a pharmacist? Did they speak English?
They didn't speak English. They may have had some sort of rudimentary English, but they both knew French because of the French colonialism in Vietnam. And as a result of that, they had to learn a whole new language, and their degrees didn't count
anymore. Here, they had to learn English, yes.
Of course. Yeah, and they were, you know, in their 40s.
So what did they do to earn a living and to...
So they both went back to school. They worked by day and went to school at night. I think at one point my dad may have worked a stint as a mailman. My mom, I think she was a full-time student for a while, and she got a degree so that she can work in computer programming.
Oh, good for her.
So she totally switched gears And
so she was able to earn, they were able to earn a living and take care of you. And
yes.
You have siblings?
No, I'm an only child. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So go ahead. What was your life like then?
Oh, so when we first came over, we ended up all living in one house. So we had, you know, we had escaped with my mom's siblings. And so it ended up that we had a nuclear family to a bedroom in a three-bedroom house in the Sunset District.
So you had three families.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I think as an only, it's funny because people say things to me like, you do not at all seem like an only child to me. I think that it's supposed to be a compliment. But, and I look back on it and I think it's because in those very formative years, I had these cousins and we were always playing with each other. And
so you were the only child of your parents, but you weren't an only child. I think when people say that, they tend to mean spoiled, which I think is so unfair.
Right.
Because there are lots of doubles who were spoiled and onlys who aren't. Yes. Okay.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
But I think when I look back on those New Year's in America, what I remember best is that feeling of wonder and also of always feeling like at every turn there was a puzzle to try to figure out.
Like what?
Like language.
Oh, sure.
And not only that, but then trying to learn this new language. And then on top of that, hanging out with kids your age, and then they're speaking in slang, and then trying to, you know, that puzzling together of everything, or the puzzling together of people from different countries and people looking differently, or, you know, San Francisco was a melting pot, is a melting pot, and we came from a country where everyone more or less looked the same. So just everywhere looking around and...
So was that difficult for you, or I mean, because you were so young, that everything new seems normal, I'm sure, in some way. But living from one culture in the midst of another, or did you have a lot of friends in your neighborhood who were Vietnamese also, so that you could maintain?
Yeah, no, I think because I was so young, everything it was a learning experience. Anyway, and what has stuck with me from that actually is that I constantly yearn for learning and newness and freshness because that's what I'm so accustomed to in a way. And I just remember embracing it and loving
and the example
and wanting to soak
good.
Everything in.
And, and your parents were such a good example of that. I mean, to give up a life of comfort, even though, of course, it wasn't their choice, but to have to adapt into something else. And were they, what was their emotional state in all of this? I mean, were they cheerfully adventurous about it, or were they lonely for what they came from?
I think
very hard.
Yeah, I think it was the latter of struggling and on one hand being grateful that we arrived and that if we worked, you know, that American dream and thought of if we work hard enough, maybe we can rebuild our lives again.
Which they did.
And I just, you know, I'm so proud of them in a lot
be.
Of
yes,
ways.
Yes, of course. Are they homesick?
Sorry.
Are they homesick at all?
Oh, are they homesick?
Yeah. No, not homesick. Homesick, right. Do they long for... Yeah.
Yes, I think they definitely did. I think most of the time when people think of immigrants coming to America, they think of people who voluntarily decide to come to a new country so that maybe they get a better job or they can go to better schools, which
and
all
even
of
they
those
can
things
be homesick.
Are true. Right.
Yeah.
Right. But I think the case with the Vietnamese immigrants, I mean, these are really people who are in exile. And I think that gives it a certain different dimension because, you know, if you left and you were caught, you could be imprisoned. If you left, you could have drowned or died at seas or there were pirates that were kind of preying on these
people. How long were you at sea?
I think it was probably less than a week.
So it was a ship. I mean, a respectable ship. It wasn't some, so you were safe.
I mean, it was, you know, it was a possibility of it going either way. I don't think it was a ship that was ship.
It wasn't the Queen Elizabeth.
It was a fishing boat.
Oh, I see.
And actually, my father told me this story that we were on the shores of Malaysia, but the Malaysian government did not want to get involved in this international crisis, so they were not letting people dock. Mm-hmm. And a huge storm came, and these boats that were even smaller than our boat capsized, and over 12 people from two different boats died.
He saw that happen?
Well, it happened at that same time, and that's why, as a result of that, the international community put a lot of pressure on the Malaysian government, and they felt pressured enough to let our boat dock.
I see. But not to stay, but just to dock temporarily.
To dock. And then as a result of that, I think they formed this, the refugee camp. And that's why there were more refugee camps in Malaysia as a result.
So at what point did you realize that you wanted to be telling the story and that you had the beautiful talent to do it so gracefully? I mean, did you always write when you were a child? Did you keep track of things in writing or...
Yes, I think because I was an only child and we only lived in San Francisco in the house with all the other kids for maybe a year and a half. I was very drawn to writing and very drawn to reading, and you know, that's how I entertained myself because both my parents were working so hard.
And so did you come home from school before they got back from work?
Yes.
But you
it depended on what period in our lives. At one point, my mom worked the night shift and my dad worked the day shift. So when I came home, sometimes she might be there for
but there was always
half
someone,
an hour. But there were times when I would come home and there was no one there.
Oh, when you were older, I guess.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So how did your parents react to the American ways that you were learning that had to be different from what they were used to culturally and certainly for one beautiful only daughter?
I think
anything special there?
Well, you know, in the stories, there are lines like where my parents didn't want me to spend the night, so it would be this huge deal. All my other little girlfriends every weekend had, you know, everyone was
slumber
having
parties.
Little sleepovers and slumber parties, and at my house, that was a big no-no.
That was not something heard of in.
No, it was just inappropriate. And
really?
Yes. And I think at one point we struck a compromise, and if I got good grades and straight A's or something, I might get to spend the night for one day a month. You know, so out of the 30 days, I got to pick one friend where I could go and hang out with them for a slumber
party. And did you get to have – well, you probably didn't have enough space for friends to come to your house, or maybe you did.
They were more keen on that idea, but –
Oh, so that was okay with them if they were – so they wanted for safety to be the one to oversee you and protect you.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
But, you know, I think, for example, my mom wasn't that keen on me doing sports, whereas you would think, you know, most American parents think that it's a great thing and, you know, it builds camaraderie and teamwork. And I just – it was little things like that.
So do you – I don't know if you know this, but like, what was a girl's life growing up in Vietnam when your parents were younger? I mean, it just wasn't sports and that sort of thing. It wasn't important.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Talk to us about your book if you like it. I noticed that you have a couple of pages marked. Would you like to read us any part? I mean, I didn't know if that's what you would like to do.
I'm happy to read if you'd like me to
read
part of it.
Why don't you just take maybe a few minutes and read maybe a couple of paragraphs that might be important to you in this bookmarked page.
Oh.
I don't know why it's marked.
I think it's marked because it is the story Silver Girl that I was reading for a bit.
Oh, okay. So how did you enter this? I mean, what's your opening paragraph, for example, maybe?
Okay, let me...
And how did you come to this title?
Quiet as They Come?
Mm-hmm.
I came to the title because on one hand, I thought of how people have these preconceived notions or the stereotype of Asians as being quiet and silent and not as verbal. And so I thought of quiet as they come.
Is that an honest cultural difference about not being as verbal or expressive of certain things? Or
I don't think so, you know. And there's a particular story which is called Quiet as They Come, and one of the main characters, this man, Viet, his coworkers describe him as being quiet as they come, but without realizing the volcano that's about to erupt inside of him. And I don't want to give away the climax of the story, but it speaks to that. And at the same time, I thought it was provocative with all of the conversation and the dialogue in America today about immigration, and comparing it to in the 80s, when I was still fairly young, but hearing people saying like, oh, all these Asians are coming to the Bay Area and taking their jobs. And, you know, they're coming over quiet and stealth and kind
You heard people talk like that?
Kind of, yes. Yeah, in the news and, you know, on the radio, or hearing my parents telling stories or my family members telling stories about, I think, some of the struggles that they dealt with in the outside world. And then finally, I thought of I had a friend who said when she saw the title, she thought of it as quiet, pause, as they come, and imagining this regal procession of people entering and giving them that sense of dignity and attention that they deserved. So I liked those varying meanings of it.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
So is there any little thing that you would like to,
to give us
a flavor of it?
Yeah, I'll read a short story called Silver Girl. I'm reading it.
So read us like a few paragraphs of it, or however much time will allow us.
Okay, okay. That sounds good. And it's based here in the Bay Area, so it might be fun. On the 4th of July, we glide through the winding roads of Mount Tam with the top down. Treetops sway and leaves shimmer like tinsel when the moon hits just right. Over the railing, the Pacific coast is as placid as a lake tonight. Phoebe's dad takes the curves hard and fast. He pumps even harder when Aretha Franklin goes off on her scat. Her lungs are like the gale winds of the bay, but still, Stan puts the music loud. He's a jazz musician. He plays trumpet. He's deaf in one ear from his years next to a speaker. Phoebe and I are squeezed together in the front bucket seat. We're bundled up in matching sweaters and blue jeans and scream with the turns of our stomachs. We're hunched over with the heat high, our noses nestled against the vents, cheeks touching. We like the hot cold look of reddened cheeks, chapped lips, the wind through our hair. We like how it feels even better. Phoebe's dad says we're complicated women. Already we groove on contradiction. I like being called a woman. My father would call us kids.
That's very nice.
I can stop there.
It's very nice.
Thank you.
And so just while we're on the subject of your reading it, tell us where people can buy this book. I'm guessing Amazon, because what can't you get there? But
yeah, on Amazon. And, you know, I like to support the independent bookstores, so they can go to Books, Inc.
In
San Francisco. There's Diesel in Berkeley. There's Pegasus Books in Berkeley. They can also get it at, you know, Barnes and Nobles and Borders and so forth, too. So,
and you have a website you'd like to tell us?
Yeah,
about,
my website is www.angiechow.com. And you can find.
Wait, let me just. Angie Chow, angiechau.com.
Yes.
Oh, I'm only saying that because
Janet,
if people miss a letter or a word, they won't get to you.
Yes.
Okay.
That's perfect.
Okay.
So there's just some news and reviews and up to coming dates where I'm doing readings and so forth.
Oh, lovely. You have a beautiful way of reading it, too.
Thank you.
When you, because we're about love letters over here, and really the importance and loveliness of letting people know in your own handwriting. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, and I don't know if you, you know, having fled a country, I don't know that you would have any memorabilia or letters from people from your past. Do you? Handwriting is magic, I think.
I know. No, actually, I have a sweet story. My dad, when I was 2 years old, wrote a poem for me. He said he was on our front porch. This is in Vietnam, in our hammock, and I was taking a nap. Yeah, and I was only 2 years old. And so, and I don't know what I did, but he wrote a poem, and you know, he saved it through all of those years of us escaping by boat and, you know, living in San Francisco, living in Sonoma County. And he saved it for 20 years.
So
and
you have it.
He gave it to me for my 22nd birthday.
Oh, I'm going to cry. Okay.
And it was so sweet and so special. And he's a neat man. He's a man of letters. And he, you know, he's a poet, philosopher. And
you're smiling because you know something extra about him through this letter.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean, I can feel from where I sit what I think you know. What do you know? What do you know from getting a love letter from somebody?
Oh, I just felt this deep well of love. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, his true curiosity about me as this new creature
respectful.
In his life. Yes.
Of you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yes, even as a child?
Oh, definitely.
And you probably have this forever. So have you written love letters to people in your life? Something
yes.
in your own house? You have?
Yes.
Good. May I ask, like, I mean, I don't want to pry if it's like boyfriends or something, but just to
no,
anybody.
I'm a big proponent of showing one's appreciation mm-hmm. and being grateful today.
Yes.
And so I've written what I would consider love letters to, you know, my mom, to my dad,
to a boyfriend,
to a cousin.
Because the point is they're not just for romance.
Yes.
They're for any area of gratitude in your life.
Yes.
Or sometimes just, I remember this and wanted you to know, I remember the time when I was 6 and you took me to, it doesn't matter, fill in the blank.
Yes.
People are so thrilled to get that.
Yes. And I think that's why when I heard about this show, I was so excited to participate.
Well, thank you. So let me ask you, if you were to write a love letter right now, which we always ask, let's say you, who gets your love letter right now today?
Today, I would write a love letter to my Aunt Tammy.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is such an inspirational woman. There is a character named Kim in my book, Why Does They Come? And Kim is a single mom in her early 20s with two young children that she has to raise on her own in a new country.
Is that who your Aunt Tammy was, in fact?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she had two.
Yes. Uh-huh. And she, meanwhile, her husband is imprisoned in Vietnam, and she doesn't know whether he's dead or alive except for these, you know, threadbare letters that she receives perhaps every 6 months or 9 months or a year. And yet she continues on with this perseverance and, I think,
so
humor.
How would you start this letter? This is just so lovely. I mean, more than lovely. This is gorgeous. So you haven't written to your Aunt Tammy yet?
No.
Oh, so it'll be a new gift for her.
Mm-hmm.
And will you just dive right in and say this character is you? Does she know that?
She knows that the character is inspired by her strength and her story, but also very clear that it's fictionalized.
Sure.
And there's a lot that's expanded for the sake of drama and that three arc kind of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
There's a love interest in the story.
I see.
And so I don't want to portray it as if she has
but even more powerful in a way, it seems to me, to have real life be that there isn't a love interest, that she's here not knowing whether her sweetheart is dead or alive,
mm-hmm.
and she has to go on. So I guess you'll just say all that right out to her.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she'll be, she doesn't, obviously you're a grown woman, you don't live with them anymore, but
mm-hmm.
So you mail it to her and on some kind of stationery that's beautiful in her?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And actually, in truth, her husband, my uncle, did arrive in America after we were here for 12 years. And they
wonderful.
Were reunited. And he is such a lovely, lovely, strong man that went through so much.
You have to be.
And yet, they were the solid couple after, you know, over a decade of being separate. And he actually, he passed away last year and we had a memorial service for him this last weekend. And so she's especially in my thoughts.
Oh, okay. And you've got other people in your life. I mean, I'm always saying that, you know, even though we do this here and hope to be an inspiration to our listeners and give them the bravery and sometimes the tools to do it, it's not a one-shot deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's so many people in life, and just to take a moment to write something down on a card or a piece of paper and stick it in the mail, it's amazing to me. I mean, I have heard stories about lives being changed by the smallest consideration that's mailed, that they stay on the bedside table for years and people read them over and over again.
Yes.
And to older parents who will pick this letter up, and I'm not talking about parents who have any cognitive disabilities. I'm talking about older parents who are sharp, mm-hmm. will still pick these letters up every few months and read it as if new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's so special. And in the fast, rapid fire world of texting and yes. emails, there's something so special about receiving a handwritten note that
in
you can
mail,
continually reopen to read. And I love that, but I'm
old-fashioned
in that way. Which
I don't think people do that with emails the same.
No.
And you might get an email and print it out,
mm-hmm.
but there are a couple of things with that. I love email. I mean, I'm so addicted to it, and I love the immediacy
right.
of it. I drew a line at texting, but I do love email. But there is, you can print it out, and you have to go download it, and you have to get the luscious paper. And with all you do, and we had one guest here who actually did that with all the letters from her sweetheart. But where's the proof that he was there? There's no signature,
mm-hmm.
and nobody's touched it.
Yeah,
you know, when you receive a letter or you send a letter, Your hands have been on it. You may have pressed your lips to it and given it a kiss before you put it in the mailbox.
Yes.
You certainly licked the envelope shut. You're all over that thing.
My friend and I were in Venice, and I think we have a perfect gift for you. I have to think about it. But there's this really neat store along the canal, and they sell things for stationery and letter writing. And it's a wax, you know, one of those wax imprints.
Where a seal.
You can, yeah, a uh-huh. seal where you can, every time you do it, you can
yes.
have the stamp
yes.
and have your initials. And I've had it, I have to admit, in my drawer for 3-4 years now, thinking, okay, I'm going to write letters. I'm going to have that little stamp uh-huh. for Chow, and I have not used
By the way,
it yet,
and
so
that's,
I must.
Oh, you should, because that's an extra important. I mean, that was the regal
right.
sealing, the
right.
seal. I mean,
yes,
that was
yes.
it. Oh, you should do that. And that goes with quiet as they come, the Regal family. Okay. So I hope in your life you will write a lot of letters. I'm sure you will. And as you said, your book is really a love letter,
mm-hmm.
but it's not something that has your personal handwriting in it.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be just something extra special.
It will be.
Thank you so much for coming to do this with us and for reading that beautiful passage.
Thanks for having me, Janet. It was
and
a pleasure.
I hope people, I mean, I read quite a bit of it on the internet. You
okay.
were generous enough to do that so
oh,
we could
good.
Get a feel for it. And it's gorgeous.
Thank
and
you.
it's so nice to see other people's stories, I think,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
we learn from them.
Yeah.
You know, we learn about being brave, and we learn about not being spoiled and not taking for granted. And
what I think has been neat, too, is when I've gone to do readings, I'm never quite sure what to expect with regard to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been such a neat, diverse mix of people who come of all ages, of every rainbow you can imagine.
Nice.
And yet people say, I really connected with this story
yes,
because
my story
of this,
too.
Yes, of
yes.
this universal theme of,
yes.
you know, the first story is called Hunger, of being hungry,
yes.
of
well,
being a kid.
Yes.
And,
okay.
You know, so.
Thank you for, don't give too much, as
okay.
you said, away. But thank you for mentioning that because that's true.
Yeah.
And, okay, well, I guess I have to say goodbye now on behalf of us both. But I want you to remember that if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion. So for now, I will just say goodbye. This is Janet Gallen telling you goodbye, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.